Welcome, everybody. Christina Wolf here. And I have with me Salma Morningstar. And this is the sexual healing and patriarchy discussion that we have been talking about. And today I wanted to bring up this really powerful topic because it's been on my heart over the last several months. And me and Salma have had some very healing discussions around how to process really difficult emotions. And so I wanted to, for those of you who are not familiar with Salma and her work, I'd like to introduce you to her. And if you could tell the audience a little bit more about what you do and what is the Womb-Centered Healing Temple.
I'm Salma Morningstar, and I am a womb healing specialist, and I'm a womb awakening mentor, and I'm an embodiment, a feminine embodiment specialist, to be more specific about that. And so what that means is womb awakening is about awakening, recognizing and activating our feminine power, our womb power, that has been largely ignored, neglected, and suppressed for many thousands of years in the patriarchal system. And a big part of that is full embodiment, full spiritual embodiment, full emotional embodiment, full physical embodiment of really getting in touch with our whole bodies, including our womb space as women, especially because that's one way that women and everyone really has coped with the suppression of being in a body that is central to the patriarchal systems, is, and then we escape, we disembody, we disassociate. And so the embodiment practices is part of that recovery and that reclaiming and reawakening of our womb power, our feminine power. And so the Womb-Centered Healing Temple is an online space that I recently received the call to create. And it's a collaborative space that whose intention is to bring womb-centered healing practitioners together to offer events and services to a larger community and really lift each other up. So those who want to learn about womb-centered healing for their own healing process, as well as those who want to develop their service, vocational service to the world and helping other women to learn as well. We can all lift each other up in a community of sisterhood, and it's based on online, although there are murmurings of having in-person retreats and events as well. So
I hope,
yes. And it wouldn't be so far for you coming from Texas to come to California, and I'm sure you would probably enjoy that, but there's people all over the world in the Womb-Centered Healing Temple, and I don't know if they're going to come, but California is, I mean, I live in a destination area, so I can set it up at some very nice resorts to have some retreats like that. So we shall see what the goddess has in store.
Well, I wanted to touch on a few things you mentioned about the embodiment process. I think my particular difficulty in being safe or comfortable or even enjoying being in the female body was one of the reasons why I've been on this kind of lifelong quest for womb healing. I didn't realize that's exactly what it was, but you know, a lot of people who know me, I have a lot of very masculine traits. I work in a very masculine profession, law enforcement. I was in the military. And yet, on the other end of it, I'm into herbal medicine and shamanic practitioner. And, you know, so this sort of push-pull of the inner feminine, inner masculine has been a very big, what I like to call soul journey for me. And I think many women in our culture are having this exact internal conflict. And when we talk about the patriarchy, I want to be clear. I'm referring to the very specific process of suppressing the feminine, not necessarily just women, but feminine traits, things that are valued as feminine, nourishment, agreeability, nurturing children, those sort of things. And so when we think about the patriarchy, and for me, I think what gets people's back up is thinking that one is better than the other. And I think we've talked many times about how we all have masculine and feminine traits. And I think for me, the biggest imbalance was overvaluing masculine traits over my feminine traits. And that suppression led to disease in my body, namely womb-centered diseases like endometriosis and heavy periods and PMS. And from a metaphysical sense, women like me who have been indoctrinated or culturized, is that the culturalization of women like me, to believe that to be feminine is to be weak, to be powerless. And so we overvalue working, making money, all of these very typically masculine traits. And I feel like that has harmed me in some ways, that it's made it difficult for me to really truly connect with my male partners in my life. My first marriage, I was definitely the breadwinner type head of household. And I found that extremely dissatisfying. It wasn't what I really wanted. And so in my new partnership, I allow him to take the lead much more. And so we've had some really powerful discussions about patriarchy and what it means. And in the irony, I have embodied far more feminine traits since talking about the patriarchy and this whole process of, you know, healing the womb, because I believe the suppression of the inner need to express these things in our society is what's harming us. I really think that that may be a form of suppression of the feminine, is women who fear being too feminine because it's weak. You know, and at the same time, now there are partnerships where we want to express that side of ourselves with our jobs, with our personal partnerships. And that's why I bring up sexual healing, because I found after many of the discussions, sociopolitical discussions I've had about the patriarchy and feminism, that it was affecting the intimacy in my personal relationship. And this new paradigm away from the patriarchy is sacred union, where the divine masculine, divine feminine is equally respected and they work together. And that's the model. That's the new model. And so what do you have to say about the process? Like me, we could maybe take people through the process I had, where I was really struggling with how do I enjoy opening up and being safe and feminine with my partner if I'm feeling angry and like closed up about the trauma and the rage of feeling this suppression, this domination, if that makes sense. And some might argue that that doesn't exist, and we're not here to discuss that. We're here to help people process their feelings if they are feeling that rage or that, you know, disconnect, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. So what do you have to say?
Yeah, well, you touched on a key word there towards the end of what you were sharing, which is the patriarchy is from a domination model. So And that's very obvious and plain. You know, you don't have to look back in archaeology to see that. It's still going on today. And that's the domination of the masculine over the feminine. And there's a couple of things that come up around that as we are recognizing this pattern as unhealthy, as we're seeing over the last, you know, number of thousands of years, that it's really not healthy for humanity to have this domination model. It may have been an adaptive thing at one point where, you know, one theory about how patriarchy got started, this is a big question, because it's so unhealthy for us. How did we get started on this, right? And so there's one theory that there was a big cataclysm with the asteroid hitting the planet. Suddenly food is not as available. There's a rift that happens when we undergo a trauma like that between the logical thinking brain and the subconscious. The subconscious, the body naturally suppresses the chaos of the subconscious and the emotions in order to be logically thinking and getting solutions and surviving, right? So that's a natural adaptive response. And that sort of happened on a collective basis where some men who are best able to do that and really disconnect, and they just took it a little too far. All right. And so that's where we're at. We're in a big collective trauma, repeating process. And so when we start to have self-compassion for the whole species, we can start to say, oh, okay. And when we see, for example, in our partners, who I'm hoping is somebody that we fell in love with at some point, and that we have an unconditional loving approach to at some point, the men that we may be partnered with are going to have been raised in the patriarchy, which taught them to some degree or another, at least to have some relationship of domination over their feminine inside of themselves. We have been taught as women to have our masculine traits dominate our feminine traits. So when we see that as a collective ailment, then we can start to, feel the anger, the grief, the pain of the disease and about the disease, but we don't need to take it out on ourselves or take it out on our partners or perpetuate that. We can start to use our best trauma healing, trauma recovery skills, which say that actually, you know, taking revenge on someone isn't really getting you anywhere. Yes, you need to feel your anger. You need to release it from your body. You need to feel whatever feelings are coming up and let your body go through whatever unwinding it needs to feel those feelings fully and release them, release the energy, the survival energy that's behind a lot of those emotions. And then find the core of your own inner power on the other side of that. And that's the thing with the domination model. We have to start to look and see what the reality is. The truth in that domination model is not what we've been taught. What we've been taught is that the dominators have the power. But the truth is, dominators are completely dependent on other people to get their power. They have to have someone to dominate and to take power from in order to have any power, because the locus of their power is outside of themselves. So their power is measured by how much money they have, how many, you know, lovers, beautiful, sexy young wives they can have in a row or all at once, maybe. how many people they have control over and will do their bidding. Okay. So that is an external locus of power. They're completely powerless on the inside of themselves. And that's why
narcissism involved. Like, that sounds very much like narcissistic personality disorder.
That is
used, exactly, people as sources rather than in interconnection. And I think that's probably why this disorder is coming up so much in people's relationships. They're noticing this as a toxic relationship pattern. And it's not just a man to a woman.
I would call it, and I would call it something a little bit different even than toxic. I would call it parasitic.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, you know, a toxin is, you know, of course, a substance that's harmful. So there could be, you know, even in with a parasite, there's usually a toxin or a whole setup of toxins involved, say with like, you know, abdominal parasites, right?
There are ways
to get biomystical with you, right? Just to get biomystical, right? So there can be a toxin that numbs the site of the sucker of the parasite attaching to the host's body, right? There's some numbing there. There might be another toxin that dissolves the tissue or the blood or whatever that, right? And so there we see all these
completely unaware that they're being drained.
Exactly.
So,
And so that parasitic relationship, then, you know, that parasite is dependent on that host. And, and, you know, it makes me also, there's another biological metaphor that I use to describe the domination model, but it's a little bit off, and I'll explain how, but you got to let me get to the full circle of the little story here. So there is a symbiotic relationship between a sea snail and a jellyfish, okay? Where they attach themselves to each other, and one of them will start parasitizing the other and grow really big, and the other will shrink really small. But it gets to the point where if they parasitize the small one any longer, that small one will die, and then the big one is also going to die because it has no longer a source. So that's, it can't suck anything more from the small one. Just before it dies, it stops sucking off of it. Then the small one starts to suck off the other one and grows bigger and bigger and they go back and forth like this.
Wow.
And it's somewhat like the yin yang symbol. Okay. Where the feminine grows big and fat and there's a seed of the masculine in the center, but it's at the skinniest when the feminine is at the fattest. And then the masculine grows big and fat and it's got the seat of the feminine in the center, and the feminine's the skinniest when the masculine's the fattest. And so there's this sense that there's a natural flow and flux between the two, the dualities. Now, I feel that it is possible and that it's very adaptive, especially for a species like us who's taken it to such an extreme, to come to a partnership model where there's not a domination, where instead of just sucking off one until it's to the brink of death and then back and forth, that there's a mutual give and take where both partners are nourished by the presence of the other. And there's plenty of models in nature of that. And we talk about this snail and jellyfish because it's sort of not really the norm, right? But most ecosystems have an equal partnership between all of the components, and it's balanced when it's a healthy ecosystem, and that there's a cooperation even at a microorganism level between all of the organisms living in harmony in order to have a healthy system. Our body is an example of that, of a healthy co-created cooperative partnership between all of these organism cells, parts that work together and nourish each other and receive nourishment from each other. And so that model is what I feel we, those of us who still retain and start to learn to cultivate and protect our inner power, our womb power, or for men, those who don't have a womb, it's the Hara power. If you used to have a womb, it's your womb space power, right? This direct connection to source and inner power, which is the true power. When we start to learn to value that not because we're making that dominant over something else, but just because that's the true power. Mm-hmm. That's what's really of value at all. And this other model recognizing the fallacy of it. And when we see that dominating, having any kind of one aspect of ourselves dominating another aspect of ourselves completely undermines our power, the very thing we're trying to get.
Right.
Then it's like, oh, why was I playing that game? That doesn't make any sense, right? Totally made me sick. Took my power away.
Why are we playing that game? And I think some of it, if you go back to the snail and the jellyfish thing, one of them who's being, the parasited, the source.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have to be in a weakened state where they don't feel that they have any agency, where that I don't have a sense of self. I am only me with you stuck mm-hmm. on me basically. And mm-hmm. I think if you look at those narcissist empath relationships, some of that is very similar, that when the empath decides I have boundaries and I don't need you and I'm cutting you off, then their source is gone. But mm-hmm. there's an inherent sense that as an empath, my desire is to nourish and to give mm-hmm. and to be a source, basically. But mm-hmm. there isn't that underlying understanding of partnership. One wants to dominate, the other one wants to partner. And then somewhere in there, it becomes, like you say, toxic. mm-hmm. So what if we're in that predicament? Where, other than becoming a full sense of agency. And I will say this process of needing to find validation externally is, in fact, a masculine concept for anyone. When I say masculine, feminine, I'm not talking like just a man, just a woman. I think in our culture, men are taught not to value their inner intuition, and women, if they do, it's considered a form of hysteria or chaos, or it's not valued. And so the women who suppress their feminine to function in a patriarchal society are operating in a very masculine way. And I've said it multiple times. And so what we have is many people running around trying to find source outside of themselves. And that's where the dysfunction is. Because then they maybe find someone who has that sense of agency or internal compass, or they are connected to source. And it's not the norm to talk about it, to develop that, to, us having these discussions, most of the time, I've had to kind of go outside my normal circles to have these sort of conversations. I know the average person probably isn't going to be thinking about this on a conscious level. And for those of us who are, the problem with that is they're still feeling all these feelings. They're still experiencing the beingness of this unsymbiotic dominated relationship, and they're not processing the feelings of that in a healthy, conscious way. And so
they're just perpetuating it. They're just repeating the pain and perpetuating the suffering of it.
And there's one other little piece you were saying, that maybe we have this big cataclysmic event in our history of a species, and we're just like, this domination is a response to that trauma, as you were saying. But maybe now we're starting to feel safe again to express those safer feelings of nourishment. There's no need to dominate if we trust that we're going to nourish each other, And so what do you think about this process of shifting from fear of being dominated? For me, that was the biggest thing. I was over masculine because I was, mm-hmm. I had fear of being dominated. I had a sense that this was not right, that I did have a sense of agency. And I do think that many women who feel anger or rage at that lack of agency or domination are then attacked for having those beliefs. So, you know, there, it's kind of
I have a few things to say about that. One is we can feel anger or rage, and then we can choose what to do with that anger or rage. If the only option that we are aware of or have been programmed to respond to our own rage or anger that we feel is the option of dominating somebody else, then when we feel that anger and rage, and what we do with that anger and rage will be perpetuating the domination, and will evoke further domination from others towards us. So there is, and I'm not saying that when somebody feels dominated by somebody else, that it's their fault. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying we have to choose how we engage with that energy. Okay. Yeah. And so what that means is, instead of, or whether or not we even engage with that energy. So for me, I have a lot of anger and rage towards my father, for example. But I figured out long ago that if I try to express that to him, all that does is he's much better at dominating than I am, and it just makes him dominate me even more. So it serves absolutely no purpose. It absolutely does not help me to get free of the domination cycle to express my anger and rage to him in any way, shape, or form. I at one point very calmly and very clearly, even tempered, wrote him a letter saying, deliberately disinviting him from my wedding, because my sister warned me that just not inviting him wasn't going to do the trick, that he would probably crash my wedding if he heard about it from any of his brothers who I had invited, right? And I'm like, okay, I don't want him showing up. I don't want to have to deal with him at my wedding, because there is no other way of being with him except to be dominated by him. He has no other relational pattern available. And I didn't want that. And so he proceeded to try to dominate me in his reply letter, you know, which, okay. But if I had come at him with, you know, and shared my anger with him at all, it would have been much worse.
Well, because
it was
language at that point. And he's
exactly.
Let's go.
People who are into domination, they want you to be upset. They want you to engage. They want you to pour your energy into this emotional interaction with them. And they're always going to be better at dominating than you are.
Well, because as long as you are engaged and distracted, you're not fully, you're only in reaction mode, and you're not fully expressing yourself as, you know,
full. And so the best. So the better thing that I've found, the more effective thing and more empowering thing for me to do with my anger, is to let it be the motivation that I need to make the changes in my life, the structural changes in my life that nurture my inner power independent of the dominators. So, you know, we talk about doing anger release and all of that. I say, feel that anger. Yes, sometimes we need to do the anger release, but I say, feel that anger and let it be the fuel for making the tough changes you might have to make to find your, to create, setting the boundaries, setting the boundaries to get yourself away from them, but also to nourish your own sovereignty, whether that's financial sovereignty or, you know, emotional sovereignty. You know, take it to a therapist. Take that anger to a therapist, and a somatically oriented therapist at that. You know,
I would say, and let me interject one thing though. It's easy to stay in that angry place because I've been there. I've got lots of fuel. You know, I've got lots of fuel in my relationship. At some point though, there needs to be a, like you say, a release of it, a softening. And I think a lot of people feel that anger may be the only safe emotion, especially men. I feel like men, even though they're hurt, they're sad, they're jealous, they're whatever, the only acceptable emotion is anger. And so for women, sometimes getting angry is the hardest thing for them to do, and that's a good thing. It's kind of like, again, in, you know, traditional Chinese medicine, if you have a disease that's based on coldness in your body, they apply heat, you know, and vice versa. If you have too much heat, you need to apply cold. So everything's about balance. So for me, I felt like I had way too much yang energy, way too much anger in my relationship. And I've had to apply the yin. I had to get back into the womb centeredness. And when we started working together, it was like, wow, what a relief. Like my body was remembering a lot of things that inherently it knows and was not able to express. And where the one part that I think I want to say I struggled the most with was being in this closed off, closed hearted, angry space. And it would flare up if like I'd read something in the news, you know, like, this, you know, stuff about the Supreme Court justice guy, his whole hearings like flared me up, you know, and then, you know, whatever, there's multiple examples. You know, that young man from Stanford with sexually assaulting the girl on campus and then getting no, you know, minimal, punishment. I'd have these huge flare ups of anger at like patriarchy. And then I'm having to come home to my partner who's wanting me to be this loving, open, caring woman, and I'm just all bristles and anger. And, you know, I felt like I really had to do the work to take de-armor. Like, you and I have used that word a few times in a private conversation. Like, unarmoring yourself in your personal relationships. Mm-hmm. I do think, absolutely, there is a time and a place for armor. If you're with a very dominating, disrespectful person who is being deliberately violating of your boundaries or trying to dominate or whatever, absolutely, there's a time and a place for armor and anger. But in your personal relationships, and I say this not just with my partner, but I have three sons, and I have to look at my example of patriarchy. I can't hate men and have three sons, you know, and I don't hate men at all. I work around them all the time. I think I relate to men quite a bit more in some ways than I do women naturally. And so me working to open up and relate to women has been part of this work for me of womb-centered healing, of allowing me in because I wasn't relating to that piece within me, if that makes sense. But as I become more yin, more feminine, my boys get more of a mother. They get more of a nourishing mother. They get more of, when my oldest son has an awful lot of notions about patriarchy and feminists, I can have meaningful discussions with him where he's allowed to express his own thoughts and I'm holding space for him and not getting angry. Like, why are you thinking this way? You know, like he has very immature notions about, you know, feminism and the patriarchy and whatnot. And that's okay. Think what you need to think, but be a critical thinker, you know. think what you need to think. Yeah. But if I was stuck in that rage, that anger, I would try to shut him down. I try to dominate.
Yeah, you and know? That's why I was saying what I was saying earlier, is that as we develop our own emotional wisdom and choice, right? So anger does not necessarily mean domination, right? It's understandable that we would have that understanding or that feeling or that assumption, given the guidelines that we've seen in our society and possibly the experiences we've had with adults when we were young children and like that. So that helps us with, for me, I had a big fear of anger, both from someone else expressing it, particularly a man, and from my own expression of anger. I was afraid of that for two reasons. One, that it would evoke a bigger dominating anger from a more dangerous anger response if I shared my anger at all. That was the biggest one. But I think also that I didn't want to be that dominator. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was the only option for anger. But since then, I've learned that anger can be a very transformative energy. So like in China, you talked about Chinese medicine, anger is associated with the liver. And the liver's job is to take the toxins from the blood and change it into bile, which then goes through your gallbladder and into your stomach to help you digest the richness of life, digesting fats and proteins to be nourished. So the liver, anger, transforms the toxins of life into an assistant for your nourishment process. Mm-hmm. And of course, then it also will eliminate the unusable parts of the toxins. But our anger helps us sort that out. What's useful in this? It's the fire that sifts it, right? It sorts it out for us. If we're connected with our womb with it too, the womb is an important sorter outer as well. We can talk about that too, because our womb, we've been taught to only use one power of the womb. Well, maybe more than one, but the main one that we're taught to use as women emotionally is to hold things in. Okay. And that's in response to the whole suppression. If we really shared how we felt as women, we'd be violently treated. Okay, there's a long history in all cultures, colonization, witch burnings, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. We've had a very serious, and so it's understandable that we really strengthened that womb power of holding it in, holding our feelings in, holding our rage in, holding other people that need our care in our wombs, attempting to hold people that are dominating us in our wombs, possibly to heal them so that they don't have to dominate us anymore, right? All kinds of ways that aren't so healthy. And pretty soon our wombs are just full of too much stuff that we're holding in there. And we're not taught to celebrate and augment the womb power of releasing what no longer serves. We have that go on with our menstruation every month, this great opportunity to release any patterns, just like that liver sorts through it and releases and transmutes and finds what's useful and lets go of the rest. The womb does that in an even bigger way and can help us to differentiate, just like in childbirth, when the baby is born, the womb knows what part belongs to the mother, what part belongs to the baby, and how to disentangle those, because they're totally merged before, for blood to flow and all kinds of systems in there flowing and mutual nourishment, right? Says, okay, it's time for that baby to come out. We're going to, without harming the mother or the baby, ideally, out that baby comes. The womb knows how to do that very powerfully, more so than any other organ in the body, right? And so as we start to recognize and strengthen those powers in all aspects of our life, not only does it help us if we are going to have a baby, because our inability to do that sort of thing in the rest of our life is also going to impede our ability to do that if we're giving birth to a baby. So developing that in the other aspects of our life helps us on all counts. Okay. And so that helps us in saying, you know what, this relationship isn't working for me anymore. Or, oh my goodness, this person that I've been nurturing needs to find their own source of power. So for like children, right? Or even in relationships where you might have a mutual agreement or a soul contract of, okay, I'm going to come to you at a certain point in your life where you're going to really need my help. And I'm going to support you and nurture you. And then I'm going to let you find your own power. I think a lot of relationships have those agreements, healthy ones, that we get into trouble when we stay stuck in that way of relating where, you know, one person is nurturing the other and they're dependent on them for that power. And so the trick is to activate that womb power of healthy differentiation and say, you know what, this is your job. You know what, now this, I'm going to give this job to you. Now I'm going to let you develop that and not do it for you anymore.
And I think you're saying let them develop a piece of them. I think when women get very in tune with their womb wisdom and they become, you know, more embodied with feminine energy, they're inviting their partner to then respond or relate to them in a different way. For me, with my partner, I've had to hold myself in a certain energy for them to not relate to me in a way, like I refuse to be dominated. No, we're not going to relate to each other this way. You know, I don't want to be dominated, and that's not the kind of relating I want to do with you. So find a different way to relate to me, you know? Yeah.
And my challenge with that is I am a bit allergic to the domination model. So I'll often react in such a way that isn't conducive to building the partnership model too. So, and it doesn't even have to be a real big potent domination kind of a thing. You know, there's all kinds of subtle ways that men and women, we've all been programmed to dominate each other. And so any small little flavor of it in my husband, and it's taken me quite a few years to learn how to sort out, you know, the feelings I have about it. And you were talking about the softening. Oftentimes, my anger is covering up a much more vulnerable or tender feeling, like fear or sadness. And when I can express the full spectrum of my feelings about something, I had an example of this the other day. My husband got upset about something, a way that I responded to him, a boundary that I had. And I still have an edge when I express boundaries sometimes, especially if I know that someone really wants something and I don't want to do it. I have a fear of being dominated, right? And so I will respond sometimes kind of ineffectively out of that fear. I'll put my boundary up more strongly than it needs to be, that impedes the flow of partnership energy between us, right? Instead of making him an ally and saying, well, I have this and this going on, can you support me with this? And then it'll be easier for me to give you what you're asking for. I say, nope, can't do that. Nope, that, you know.
And so, it's difficult of determining when we're talking about a sense of agency. I think the struggle is if I give in to you, I give up sense of self. And I think I really want to touch on this, the actual sexual interaction piece, because I feel that I had issues with my partner looking at me from that like very typical patriarchal way of sex object, or and a lot of it was projection in my mind, you know, like I don't want to be involved with you sexually if I'm going to be treated like a sex object, or
well, you know,
merely a receptacle for your desire. You know,
and that's very complex, but it's pretty simple at the beginning if we look at it, because it's, you know, men are very, and women are too, but men tend to be very visually stimulating, visually aroused. Okay. So
from a biological sense, really.
Yes. Right. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that they're wanting to dominate. Okay. That's the programming that we've received and the experience maybe that we've had. But we can activate our womb power there to help us discern if that indeed is what's going on. And if we're with a loving, tender, attentive partner, which I'm hoping that we all are, and that if we're not and we start to activate our womb power, she's going to let us know that that's not possible with this person. And then we're going to have to move on. But if we are with a loving, attentive partner, then the womb awareness is going to come in and say, oh, what if I express this fear of being dominated instead of the anger that they're being patriarchal by looking at me that way?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I guarantee you.
Where they, you know, and then it's a different shifting of mindset where it's like, no, you're my partner. I love you. I want to be with you. And now your anger is making you inaccessible.
If you say my anger is covering up my fear of being dominated, can you help me with that?
Yeah.
And I guarantee you a loving partner is going to say, of
yes.
course, I don't want to dominate you. That's not what I have in mind.
I think
it's so attracted to you.
Deeper intimacy to be, to share that vulnerability. And it's just been my experience that most men, me and my partner, we have this saying. When I very first met him, I said, are you someone who protects the treasure or plunders the treasure? And he's like, that sat with him. Like, he'd never had to think about that before. And that was like, you know, over a decade ago. But it's been a theme for us. Like he very much feels, and I think most men, if they have a partner that they care for and they love, their goal is to love and protect them and to keep them safe. Like, I think that is one of the positive traits of masculinity is to be like a loving father figure or, you know, a protective source or presence in our lives. And we rely on that. I know if I had like, you know, zombie apocalypse here, I'd like my partner to be there to help protect me.
Yes. And then the trick is, especially, well, for both men and women, is to sort out healthy protectiveness from the domination-based protectiveness. So
yes,
we can learn.
And I had to sort of school him in subtle ways, like, if you want to provide this for me, this is the way I can receive it. You know, but when you do this, it feels like this for me, and I don't like it. You know, having those discussions and communications. I mean, we've had some very good discussions about, you know, equality and the patriarchy and what does this mean? And like, and I said, I don't think you feel that way towards me, you know, but I'm angry about it, you know, like whatever situation was going on the news or whatever. And he would sit with me and go, you know what? That's just not right. I don't like that either. And I really feel that a lot of men don't agree with the domination model. And I'm not going to say that my guy's actually a very macho, masculine alpha male. And he has had to really examine, like, he's like, you really make me think about what your experience as a woman is. Like, I've never thought this much about it. It's like, so I feel like maybe that's kind of part of, and it's his role to show me like where he's coming from too. Because I think that men are taught to believe that being a man, being masculine is bad, and it's not. There's many admirable traits. And to love that part of him that wants to protect and partner. But I will say this, I think that in our culture, the only way, I don't want to say only, I don't want to overgeneralize, but men, the only way they feel safe to express feminine qualities, like nurturing, loving, whatever, is within a romantic partnership. That they very rely heavily on their female partner as their source to express this side of them. It's not something they're going to show their male friends. You know, they won't go out and with their buddies and be like, can I cook you dinner? Let's hang out. You know, I mean, but I see where my partner is very loving and nourishing and nurturing to me.
And that is a bit of an overgeneralization, because I'll tell you about my husband. He used to work as an electrician at a big organization where there was a whole maintenance team of all the guys, right? The construction workers and the carpenters and he'd bake cookies and take them in.
See, that's good. Like
listen to this. We ran into, because he hasn't worked there for a long time, but we went back to that place as guests because it was a big resort. And we went back as guests, and his old coworkers were all showing up. Hey, how you doing? Like that. And they see me and they meet me there. And they're like, oh my gosh, you're such a good baker. And I'm like, when did you bring stuff that I baked? I never baked anything for you to bring to work. You know, and later he's like, oh, I used to bring cookies all the time. I said, but you made those. They think I made those.
He's like, that's funny. That's awesome. But for real, like his friends, his coworkers naturally assumed it was the woman in his life exactly. who did that.
Exactly. Because they couldn't see. And they were also surprised.
It mind boggled them to think like,
I know they can't figure it out. He went off to study to become a massage therapist. And now he's a recreational therapist where he provides all this amazing nurturing to all these people, not only in the two psych wards where he works, but to all the staff as well. And
he's getting to express his.
Exactly. Memory. And that's the first time he's been happy with his work in his entire life, because he gets to express his fullness.
I will say
as a human being
that for men, it's been my experience, especially with my youngest son and to a certain extent my other two older sons, but my youngest son said to me one day, I don't want to be a boy anymore because girls get to be more creative. And I said, oh no, baby, like, you know, I just, my heart was like, oh, poor thing. Because for boys, they're so conditioned, like, you shouldn't play with unicorns, you shouldn't like cats, you know, you shouldn't want to draw, that's sissy stuff. Like, there's so much of like when a boy expresses.
It's love. Shifting though, Christina. Yeah. It's shifting.
And I've had like some serious discussions with his dad about like, absolutely not. You're not going to shut him down. He likes cats. He likes drawing. He likes, you know, whatever. It doesn't mean he necessarily is going, you know, even if he grows up to be gay or transgender, I'm good with it. You know,
I feel like he's more likely to grow up being gay or transgender if he's taught that a heterosexual man can't do all the things
exactly.
that he likes to do.
Then
if a heterosexual man is allowed to do whatever he likes to do, then he can stay a heterosexual man and not have to cut it off.
I think that men are just as equally put in a box as as women are. But that is, again, an example of the suppression of the feminine. Men are not allowed to express feminine traits. It's not socially acceptable. Mm-hmm. You know, and so at the same time, I can hear my partner now, like, I don't want to do that. You're the woman. You know, there's some people that's very black and white, very cut and dry. And, you know, I kind of require a guy who is very masculine, because then it allows me to be really feminine. Because when I was with someone who was wishy-washy, I had the tendency to take over and dominate. And that was not satisfying to me. It wasn't healthy to me. It didn't feel healthy to me.
You need a certain energy to partner with, to have a balanced partner.
I bring up this book, The Clan of the Cave Bear, all the time. But it was one of the books, it was a very pivotal book in my life as a young girl. And in the story, I don't know if you guys are familiar. If you're not, it's a great book about prehistoric man. And Ayla, a human woman, lives with the Neanderthal tribe. And they have this spiritual ceremony. Kreb, the shaman of the tribe, the clan, they go through this rite of passage where she chooses her animal totem, or rather the animal totem chooses her. And she's mauled by a lion, a mountain lion, and they find her in a cave. And her adoptive mother, Iza, a medicine woman, nurses her back to health after she almost dies from this scar of being mauled by a lion. So she's got this huge lion scar on her. And Kreb, the shaman, is like, that's impossible. She's a woman. She can't have a lion animal totem. That's too strong of an essence for her. But yet he's like, nope, this is what spirit's showing to me. Like, you have this lion, you know, your lion spirit is your totem. So she later goes off into, you know, she gets exiled, but later she finds a human man who's also mauled by a lion, and that's his animal totem too. And so she's like, wow, I have finally found a match. Like, his spirit is strong enough for my spirit. And like, that's kind of how I feel about me and my partner, you know, like,
well, and it sounds
I need that strong lion energy.
Yeah. To meet the strength of your masculine. But I bet you that inside of you, you have a similarly strong feminine energies, and so does your partner.
Oh, absolutely. There are so many things about him that are very nurturing that, like, he hides very much. And I think because I allow him to elicit that, like, around me, he feels good about who he's being, if that makes sense. He doesn't have to be this big, strong guy all the time. He can let down his guard a little bit. And he knows I'm going to have the ability to take care of him if he needed it, which he doesn't like the idea of, but I think it gives him a sense of safety too.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because women have, I know I have sort of grumbled about this way that it works to smooth things with male-female relationships, in that we all kind of know that if we really want something that our husband might not agree with, that if we make it feel like it was their idea, or allow them to have the idea that it was their idea, and my husband and I joke around this all the time, even though there's a little kernel of truth in it, you know, if I wait for it to become his idea, then he's all about it. But I know I planted the seed 6 months ago and he raged against it. Right. And so, what I'm getting right now as you're sharing about that is that it goes the other way too, that possibly we can find a way to allow, allow our husband's nurturing, our feminine side, to be expressed through us. But does that mean we're going to do all the dishes? That's not right.
No, I mean, he does dishes too. Like, But see, this is the difference. He came to me already feeling that he is a self-sufficient person. And maybe I think that's another aspect that I like about him. Didn't want me to bother him at all.
Right. And I think, though, that it's going to, where it can show up that way is through sexuality. So it feels to me the more we melt into our own feminine openness around our sexuality, the more men can express both their masculine and their feminine side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we're already over dominating. Everybody is already too much masculine and needs to come out a little bit more feminine.
Yeah.
And the two together will be the balance, really. Mm-hmm.
And so if we can model that balance of, you know, the sexy place is where the feminine is totally revered. That's the sexiest place.
Mm-hmm.
Where the feminine is being worshipped and where the feminine pleasure is brought to its ultimate height, because the feminine body is the guide to pleasure. I mean, that's where all the pleasure resides. And the more pleasure a woman is having, the more pleasure a man can have. And so if we shift that focus and become devoted to our own pleasure, not depending on the man to give us the pleasure, but to become devoted to our own pleasure, then he wants to be involved in that pleasure. And we can certainly train him in how to be in service and devotion to our pleasure.
Well, and I think it asks them to expand outside of the comfort zone of the very oversimplified sexuality that's being fed to young men and men in general.
It's a teenage level of sexuality that most men are operating into, because they haven't been initiated into full adult sexuality. And most women, for that matter, are the same, because we don't have sex positive initiation for teenagers. Well,
or I would even venture to say a desire to become aware or conscious of something beyond the reactionary state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's most of the population is in, you know, unaware asleep state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone who feels so enlightened will always have a little bit more enlightenment to go. You know?
Exactly. And the thing is with embodiment, like we were talking about at the beginning, you know, there's a difference between spiritual practices that are about transcendence or ascension or liberation from the cycles of life and death. And that's often, you see a lot of practitioners say who were severely traumatized as children, who coped with their trauma by completely disembodying,
mm-hmm.
and dissociating from their bodies. And they explored all of the unseen realms completely disembodied from their bodies and developed all of these sensitivities, parapsychology, you know, all these interdimensional travel, all of this, because they were escaping.
That in like Gnosis, spirit is considered masculine.
Mm-hmm.
Being in the body is feminine and evil. Like, look at the witch trials. They looked at, you know, just the concept of it. Women were inherently evil because they incited lust in the physical flesh body.
That's all the foundational belief system of this spiritual system of saying, in order to reach,
be celibate,
right? In order to reach connection with divine, you have to leave the body, that heaven is someplace else out there, not on this planet.
Exactly. Okay?
So that whole foundational belief system that the feminine is evil because she keeps perpetuating this you know, embodiment and sexuality and birth.
Literally where spirit comes into the physical world.
So feminine spirituality is invites the energy in the other direction and has a cosmology of, wait a second, no, heaven is here on earth. If we can fully bring our spirit into physical form, which our bodies are designed to do as women, and of course male bodies have the assistant role, protective role, to support this embodiment of spirit, full embodiment in spirit. And in that process, we are learning that actually we can alleviate human suffering. Instead of escaping from it, we can actually fully embody and really engage with it and use, you know, activate our emotional wisdom, our womb power, our creative power to create a new world that honors the body and that brings full spiritual awareness and awakeness into our physical form. And there are many cultures, ancient cultures.
Spiritual and physical.
Exactly.
Is a marriage. Which
That's right. A partnership. Yeah. And so that embodiment, these embodiment practices are really important for that. And one of, you know, so we've been talking about some of the first things that happen. You discover your grief, you discover your forbidden feelings, you learn how to navigate them, you relearn how to be in partnership.
I also think illness is a huge teacher as well. Like for me to learn embodiments, practices, illnesses like my migraines, like my endometriosis, those things taught me to look at different ways of putting energy through my body and learning to be in my body. Like those are all signs that I'm not comfortable being in the female body, right? Or a body, period. and so if you are feeling like maybe stress in the body, physical ailments, to use womb-centered healing as the starting point for embodiment, physical, you know, you gotta heal the disease by moving the energy back in a more positive, I almost say positive, but feminine way. Because if you're over yang, you need yin, you know, you need the balance.
Yeah. And, you know, my experience with a lot of womb-centered healing practitioners is that, like myself, is that I did a lot of embodiment practices for a long time before I ever called it womb-centered healing. Mm-hmm. Because, and that's becoming the thing right now, because collectively we're at a place where we're recognizing that, and many more and more people are waking up to the importance of that. But for many of us practitioners, I mean, I had a sense of it, but I would never have called it womb-centered healing until just a few years ago.
And
that brings it to the whole sexual healing part. You know, we notice, I just want to point out that in this discussion about sexual healing and patriarchy, we're not talking about sexual techniques.
No.
A lot of people who get drawn into the whole tantra thing and, you know, learning how to breathe and do certain sexual techniques in order to have a better sex life end up skipping over this emotional aspect that is the building, that are the building blocks of true intimacy. And so there's a lot of sexual exploration out there that develops that I'm such a great sexual performer, I can do all this and that. And so I just want to caution people to that, because you know, that's the same kind of sexuality with a disconnection. Sometimes not everyone who's practicing that way is disconnected in that way. But for me, the sexual healing comes from that true emotional intimacy being attended to and addressed.
Yes.
And because that was the real reason why I was unable for me, because that those issues made my body sick, and didn't matter what sexual technique you were going to do, I was in pain, and so I didn't want to do it to begin with.
Because you still have the trauma in you. You were still holding that trauma in
you.
Yeah,
exactly.
There wasn't a safe space to release it and to be safe.
Yeah.
And I will say that the trust factor is enormous. The ability to be vulnerable and safe, that is, to me, the crux of, like, where we come together.
Yeah. And there's you know, there's kind of a spectrum of how we address trauma healing. And in these transcendent, transformational, intensively sort of heroic healing modalities that want to dismantle the ego as quickly as possible so that we can transcend and escape the cycles of suffering, often what's done with trauma is to sort of scrutinize it, penetrate it, bust it apart, rip the scab off, right? So all of our ego patterns are coping mechanisms that we've developed to deal with the pain of our unhealed trauma. So it's like a scab. Our ego is like a scab. And so healing modalities that want to bust up the ego and just get in there and, you know, like call people out and point out their ego every time they do it. And, you know, really, they're very penetrative or masculine approaches can feel very transformational and transformative. And you feel like you have this big result, but what you've done is ripped off the scab. And now there's that wound again.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other end of the spectrum, or it's kind of more like somewhere in the middle, is to find a balance between having an awareness of the coping mechanisms, but having that awareness be soft. And there's a feminine way of healing that is that the womb is involved in, of a holding, a space, like a healing kiva or a cave. And it's dark in there, and whatever process needs to happen can happen in a safe and nurturing place. And so that's very different than getting in there, shining a spotlight on it and making it all be exposed.
Well, essentially, and you're healing from the inside out, not the outside in.
And when you do that, and when you nourish that, that and allow for and hold whatever feelings come up, it can be very uncomfortable. But it's uncomfortable in a different way than that scrutinizing spotlight approach, penetrative approach. That can be excruciating, right? Mm-hmm. So, but it's over quick, right? You get the scab off. Whereas the discomfort of leaving the scab on there, watching yourself go through the pattern again and again with soft consciousness. Oh, wow, I'm doing this same pattern with my husband again. Look at us. We're still in this same relational pattern. I really would like us to be in a different way. How are we going to go through this? I don't know. How are we going to do it different? I don't know. Is he ever going to be able to do it different? I don't know. Am I ever going to be able to do it different? I don't know. Let's try. Here we are again. Can I try something different? Maybe. I don't know. Let's see what happens, right? So there's an allowing. And there's all these feelings that can come up, especially with somatic-based therapies, like, you know, some of the embodied Shakti therapies that I do, where you just feel where it resides in your body, allow the feelings to come up, give them your attention, but a soft, allowing attention instead of a scrutinizing attention. And then that soft allowing allows deeper, more hidden wounds to arise and more tender, vulnerable feelings to arise that may have been kept in a hidden place when you were doing those scrutinizing practices, right? And those rip the scab off practices, right? And so we can start to have some discernment with the kinds of healing support and ways that we support ourselves, the ways that we hold ourselves through healing processes, and the kind of support, professional support and practitioner support that we receive, of like allowing for a softer, more feminine healing approach.
You were mentioning that, and it made me think of, like, in shamanic practices, they talk about soul retrieval due to, you know, trauma and soul loss. Mm-hmm. And the old model would be this concept of, if you imagine you have this light body or this energetic body, and let's say you have trauma here, you know, you're sexually abused as a child, and that creates this huge hole in your light body, and you're projecting almost like this holographic image in the spirit realm of your little girl is still over there, 4 years old, in this space. And when you do soul retrieval, you're calling that piece back to you to fill in the hole, to become whole. Healing all literally means to become whole, right? Mm-hmm. You're in integrity. Integrity is the whole, right? How strong is the whole? Well, Sandra Ingerman, another well-versed shamanic practitioner, talks more of the concept of soul remembering, that instead of calling that traumatized piece back to you and trying to integrate it into the whole, you know, you remember who you really are and fill in that space. And then that traumatized piece can die and go away. And it's kind of like, I like the idea of soul remembering versus, you know, let me pull back all the parts that got hurt. Because I have done ceremony where, you know, I've called my spirit back. Carolyn Mace calls it sending your spirit on a mission. A lot of throat chakra issues, and a lot of women who have thyroid issues, it's about expression, and the feminine's having a hard time expressing itself, but we're working on it and we're getting it out there. We're having a voice. But your will, where are you sending your will to? Mm-hmm. And when, and some could posit that when you're in a traumatized space, you're willfully allowing it to stay away because you fear the pain of it, right? At some point, disassociation was a good thing. Like, it was protecting you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, we could go on all day and all of the different types of healing that we've explored. And, you know, ultimately, I trust in every individual's journey. That even if they have a cycle of re-traumatization, like I did, of like even finding healers that are doing the same kind, are, you know, perpetuating the same kind of traumatic dynamics, mm-hmm. that is part of the healing process too. Sometimes we can't see that that's what's happening. And so that happens. And so, just like we repeat the same patterns in our romantic relationships or in our family relationships until we start to wake up to it, because the pain ends up being so great that we're like, okay, there's got to be a different way to do this. And so then there's a gazillion different types of healing modalities out there. And that's why I keep coming back to womb-centered healing, because there's a direct connection to source and there's a biomysticism about the womb that feels like it's the missing piece in all of this. Is if we come back to the womb and we look at the model of spirit and emotional wisdom that we have in the biology of the womb, that's why I keep describing that biological processes, and we understand things in that way, then that feels very much more grounded than a lot of these theories about this or that or the other thing that's way out here. And so, but I also want to say that we talked about doing another healing circle in around sexual healing in the womb-centered healing temple. And Christine and I are planning on sort of co-facilitating something like that, coming up in the womb-centered healing temple. What date did we decide? February 10th, Sunday, February 10th, probably at 5 p.m. Pacific time, which is 7 p.m., so look for invitations for that, and we will carry on with the discussion. But in that meeting, we will actually get into you'll join, you can join us live on a Zoom call like this and share about what aspects of this sexual healing process you're in. And then we can do some ceremony, some meditation, some embodied Shakti practices around that, or to bring healing to this important area of our lives. So thank you so much, Christina, for hosting this interview and for collaborating with me in this important healing process. It feels lovely.
Thank you for being here and sharing all your wisdom. It's, I always like being in your gentle energy.
Don't worry, I'm like stinging nettles, but my sting is beneficial to you.
I know that.
I don't know if you felt my sting, but it's there, but it doesn't, it's beneficial.
I can relate. Maybe we're very homeopathic.
Right. We have a beneficial sting. Yeah, you want to get stung by me. All right. So you have a wonderful day, everyone, and you too.
I'm here, and I hope that you all found this a very meaningful conversation. Please put all your comments, any thoughts that you'd like us to like kind of expand upon in our healing circle. We do really hope you join us. It'll be again February 10th, Sunday, and 7 p.m. Central Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thank you once again, Sama, and love you guys, and we'll talk more soon. Bye for now.